Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos. Hello and welcome to episode
180
of the Ministry of Arts podcast. I hope you here all survived it. Well, today I'm only speaking to Gavin Turk. Now, I'm well aware that Gavin's work will mean something to a fair few of you, but both him and his work mean quite a lot to me. If you're a long-time listener, you'd have heard me often mention of the letters I wrote to the YBAs back in about 1997. Well, Gavin was amongst those, and from that batch, he was the second to reply. When I put my first face value exhibition together, he was one of the first to be a part of that. And likewise, when I started this podcast back in 2018, he was one of the first I asked then as well. And although he agreed back then, for whatever reasons, it's only just happened. And on top of all of that, for 25 years, he's been one of my main influences. Well, at the moment, a sculpture of Gavin Turk, by Gavin Turk, is a part of the Kensington and Chelsea Art Trail, namely on top of the Coronet Theatre at Notting Hill Gate. And as I've also mentioned before, the artwork within this art trail is as diverse as the people in the borough. And a free public art trail at world-class quality in some beautiful surroundings, I don't think it can be beat, right? And if you're unable to walk around the borough, they've got an art bus. Yep, an art bus. And as well as talking about his work on the Kensington and Chelsea Art Trail, we start by speaking about me reaching out from within a prison cell to the YBAs, how art can absolutely change lives and why it's not used enough in prisons. And we go on to speak about his famous plaque and how a failure can be the making of you. Well, anyway, I hope this episode doesn't come over a little bit too fanboy from my corner. So please, come and join me in the studio of Mr. Gavin Turk. And I noticed that on the bottom of the ones to the men, there was a bit I didn't put. To the women, I put an adage and it said, if it's any consolation, my offence was neither violent or sexual. As if that's going to make any difference from... You know, I could have been some psycho in jail, couldn't I, you know? Not that it's going to make any difference.
But it was interesting that you only wrote that on the women's ones.
Yeah.
Not on the
plates. Now, I wouldn't have done that if it was me today.
That?
I may have either done it to everyone or wouldn't have written anything.
Yeah. Like, you're writing to people from being in the institution and not being able to go and see them or do it or phone them or anything... But then it's quite a big leap. It's quite an introduction because you're just talking to people, trying to speak to people that you've just got an idea about.
Well, I didn't even have that from the initial letters that I sent.
Because wasn't it just about books? Wasn't the original inquiry about getting a hold of a book or something for the library?
Yeah, no, it was for me.
Yeah.
But I'd seen Sensations. I thought conceptual art was just anyone can do it, you know, as many people do.
I think it is.
That's not art. Yeah, that's not art. Anyone can do it. Then one of the artworks in there completely sort of gobsmacked me, made me look at that conceptual art in a different way.
Okay.
And then...
No, but it's interesting because people always say, like, oh, was there a time when you decided you wanted to be an artist? And I don't remember any moment like that. It was a bit like becoming addicted to smoking or something, like where you just sort of drift through into it.
Did you have art growing up in the home?
Did I have art growing up in my house? Kind of, but not really. I mean, that's a bit of a squiffy answer because my dad was a jeweller, like he made jewellery. When he first kind of got going with the jewellery thing, he was a watchmaker. He was trained as an engineer. He was a watchmaker, fixed watches, and then learnt jewellery techniques in Goldsmiths College. And then he started work with a guy called Andrew Greimer. And Andrew Greimer was a very... And he is at the moment really like fashionable. He's not alive, and he's not currently producing. But his art is still his jewellery is still highly sought after. And my dad went into business with Andrew, and my dad ran the workshop. And then my dad, like in 1980, left Andrew and started his own business. And he was working doing commission work with, like, Garrard's and Cartier and big companies, big jewellery brands, known names. And then also just doing, like, kind of private work for friends and people that he knew, doing commissions for them. And that was a kind of design process. So he'd sit with someone, they'd come in, their granny had died. She'd left them a ring, they didn't like it, but they loved the stones, or they liked the metal, or whatever it was, or sentimental value, so they wanted to keep this or keep that. So it's a consultation. So my dad's with them, and, you know, he's got a bit of paper, he's drawing the possibilities, he knows how jewellery works, he knows what a gallery, you know, he knows how to get light into a stone, he knows what stones go with which stones, he knows what stock of other stones he's got, which he could add to it. So, you know, it's a creative process. So I wouldn't say my dad was not artistic, but at the same time, he never went... I don't remember him going to see any art exhibitions. No. Fine art was definitely something that was a shocker for my parents. You know, it was... I was already on a degree course, and they were still wondering when I was going to stop... and get a job.
So where did art get infused into you?
So when my thing with art was I didn't realise how much I enjoyed it. I mean, friends would come over, if it's raining I'd say, oh, let's go inside and do some drawing, and then my friends, like, at some point would kind of, apparently, so I'm told, they'd appear downstairs and I wasn't looking after them. Yeah. I was just sitting there doing my drawings. So obviously I was onto something, or I was into something, but I think I was just a dreamer. I was just a massive dreamer. And, you know, I was always being told that, you know, if my head wasn't screwed on, I'd have lost it. And, I think that there was something there. The reason why I ended up going on foundation course was partly because I did really badly in my exams and ended up, like, only having an art A level and 13. I had an art A level and 13 O levels. So I'd, I've been inside. you know, it doesn't really make sense. But basically, what happened was, like, the first time I sat my O levels, I didn't get. Whatever it was, I didn't get it. English or maths, you know, I got two D's or something. I basically at age 15, I rebelled, I think, and refused really to do any work. So So that then left me further down the line with an art A level and 13 O levels, and actually applying to an art, a foundation course, because obviously I had the grade to do that. And I was interested, but I think for me it was really like, oh, I'll just go and try and find out what, you know, what I make of this. And in actual fact, like, I think the end of the second, or the when I first started, I was like, oh, wow, what is this place? Who are these people? Like, I just don't get this at all. I'm not enjoying this. This is like eating horrible food, you know, that I'm not used to. But actually, like, by the end of the second week even, yeah, I'm starting to think, oh, actually, do you know what? This is actually more my kind of thing than what's going on there, than what I had before. So it was a bit of a sea change, even on foundation. In actual fact, like, by the time I finished my foundation, I'm totally converted to the idea that, like, I don't think that people should do, like, national service. I think everyone should get a chance to do an art foundation. Mm-hmm. And I think what that does is people don't have enough space to think about how they think or what they think, yeah, or what they like. And I think that for me, art is very much the possibility of somehow coming to terms with being a person, coming to terms with culture, coming to terms with how much of you is you and how much of you is kind of received, yeah, is given to you.
Well, that's why I go and do workshops in prisons, because it changed my life 180 degrees. I'm so much of a different person to what I was. Yeah. And that is all down to art. Because you've got to sort of, you can't look at the world without looking at yourself. And I wasn't a nice person, and I was living in a world that weren't a nice place. And then when you guys came along, or rather when I sort of pushed myself onto you guys, and you were sort of sending me stuff back in, and Angus Fairhurst.
And when you say you guys, you're talking about, like, you came across the Sensation
catalogue, yeah,
when you were inside, and you just went through it, and you actually just said, this is something in here is interesting.
No, completely, not even that.
Okay.
It was, what the fuck is all of this sort of art?
Oh, yeah.
There's a...
The letter you sent me, though, wasn't... It didn't sound like that, though. Definitely hidden that.
Because I'd been converted element by the time I wrote the letter.
Okay.
But I would say, Damien Hirst, for instance, there's a... You know, he's cut a cow in half.
Yeah.
There's a bloke on D-Wing in for similar.
Yeah.
You know, he can do that.
Yeah.
The only other person on there was Tracy Emin with a temp.
Yeah.
Marcus Harvey was in the papers at the time with Amira.
Of course.
That was the only three I knew. I never knew you. I never knew Sarah Lucas, Mark Wallinger, none of you guys, other than the three that was in the papers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Mona Hatoum's artwork that was being used. It was a postcard, mm-hmm, that the tutor who gave me the Sensations catalogue to look at, she was using it as a bookmark.
Okay.
And it was Mona Hatoum's No Way 2, which is the colander with nuts and bolts in it. Do you remember it?
Yes, yes.
And it's meant to be a dome over her homeland. She can't get back, her family can't get out, and nuts and bolts are filling the exits.
Okay.
And I've looked at it and I'm like, fucking hell, I get it. I get what all of this is.
It was a way in.
And then it sort of turned the key.
Interesting. And like, then, when there was no way in on the colander,
ironically,
that gave you a way in.
Exactly. And then I thought, she's the opposite to me. I'm inside, can't get out.
Yeah.
She's outside, can't get in. The best thing I ever done was I went back through the catalogue and there was a little description of each artwork in there. And then I'd look at it and it only give me a little snippet. And then I'd go, fucking hell, yeah, I'll get it now.
Okay.
Oh, I see where they're coming from. I was just looking at the artwork as an artwork, not the idea. And obviously, conceptual art is all about the concept.
Yeah, and also, there's a lot of space in there as well. Like, I mean, I think one of the great things that what you've just said, and where it's brilliant, is that through these tiny little words, they weren't enough to tell you what it was, but they were enough to tell you that you didn't know what it was when you just looked at the picture. And straightforwardly, it said to you, there's something here which you might not get straight off the bat. You might not be able to get it straight away.
Well, I was putting everything down in monetary forms.
Right.
Because Mona had turned around, I'd go, this is a colander
and
a bag of nuts and bolts.
Yeah.
That's a trip to B&Q in a £10 note. That
that isn't fucking art.
Yeah.
But then when I realised the gravity of what she'd put into that artwork,
yeah,
I was going, how could she say all of that with a trip to B&Q and a £10 note?
Right, yeah, good.
And that's what amazed me. And then when I was looking at all of your work again, that it was that sort of clouds parting and the sun shining through, you know. And it was only a couple of months previous when I thought, well, I've found something I like, art, discovered I'm okay at it, and I know that within this like first month of doing this art course, I've progressed a lot. I had 5.5 years left. I was good at something that didn't involve fucking crime, Gavin, you know. It was me doing it, you know, and there wasn't a fucking victim or anything, you know. Mm. I thought, I want to be part of this, so I wrote a begging letter to 32 artists, and luckily at the time, everyone was part of maybe 8 galleries, possibly. Mm-hmm. So I'd just send a letter to these artists via the gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And out of 32 letters, I got 28 replies.
Mm.
It sort of says something about that world that I'm now a part of.
Mm.
Because there was no judgment there. They was just trying to help a guy.
But it
was...
is a great story as well, because all too often, and sometimes, you know, from the inside of the art world, you think to yourself, God, the art world's so up itself. You know, it's like, God, like I just, sometimes I can't cope. You know, sometimes it just feels like people aren't listening, people are kind of, they're not interested in the right things, or, you know, they're getting the wrong messages across, or duh. There's all sorts of things where you think to yourself, oh no, you know, I'm stuck in the art world.
Yeah.
But hearing stories like that, like suddenly you go, actually, yeah, I might be stuck in the art world, but actually it's not a bad place to be stuck in. Yeah, you've got to be stuck somewhere.
Well, especially when I was stuck, well, from where I was stuck, for sure. And the thing is, Gavin, at the time, I wanted a change. I wanted a change to be a different person. I was only in the art class to get into the computer class, to jump the queue for the computer class.
Yeah.
The first letter I got was Sarah Lucas and Angus Fairhurst combined,
because
they was together at the time.
Correct.
And Sarah wrote me a letter, and there was a little note from Gavin in
Angus.
From Angus in his catalogue. And Angus said, like, the art world's changing. We need people like you in the art world.
Mm.
And then from him saying that, I was looking for this new world to be a part of, because I didn't want the crime world. And I was being invited by you guys without actually saying it, or I was feeling that I could be accepted into this new world. And knowing that I had to sort of make my way onto the first rung of the ladder when I get out, but knowing that I could be accepted in it. And if I could be accepted by you guys, anyone else in between, you guys who were at the time near the top and me very much at the bottom, I wasn't even on the first rung, I was holding the ladder for everyone else on it. That sort of gave me the okay to say, like, I can be a part of this, because then ones up there said, you know, which would quell anyone in between telling me I'm not.
Well, I went into Brixton and went into the art class there and did a little... I took some little bronzes, a little bronze apple core, painted apple core. It was bronze painted to look like an apple core. And I took that in and took a couple of other little things in there, painted matchbox and stuff, and showed them and just sort of talked about what I did as art. And it was so interesting. Like, everybody's... like such honest and just like open responses to everything they were thinking about. I mean, and as you say, some of them, and they were very clear about it, were hiding out in the art room because they wanted to get away from people taking spice, and they wanted to get away from some serious shit that was going on around the corner, which they just didn't want a part of. I mean, the art class was weird as well, because in actual fact, they weren't really allowed to do it. What it was the computers, and the computers is so weird, because you've got a room full of computers because it's referred to as design, because design is vocational, whereas with art, it wasn't seen as vocational, so they couldn't really have an art class, but they can have a design class.
Yeah.
So they've got these computers in there, so there's a room full of computers. And then, obviously, they're not allowed to go on the web, so it's like, shit, you've got loads of computers and they're not allowed to connect up to the web.
Yeah.
So they can use Photoshop, but they kind of, they can have to scan in a picture that they find in a magazine, and then they can detune that. It's just like, I'm like, oh my God, guys, this is so hard. This is such a hard place to do art, you know, really. Unless we go back to those really kind of boring things and say, well, let's do a picture of some fruit in a bowl. And it's so weird because it's like art as well now. It's so, you know, as you were saying, like you've realised that art wasn't just like a case of crafting like a picture. It was actually about having the ability to conceptualise and understand that there's a series of thinking and processes that happen before you see, before you pick up a canvas. It's already a conceptual thing to pick up the canvas. There's already a load of thought that's gone into it. There's already a kind of predestiny to the activity, and that art history and all that stuff is all in there already.
And all we had in the library was, there was probably maybe a dozen books on art.
Really?
But it would be a couple of the old masters. It would be Ralph Harris's Cartoon Time, ironically.
and I think, don't mention the Ralph.
I think I may have even put that in the letter as a little joke. But that was all we had. And then I'm getting your sort of artwork coming through, which I yet don't understand. And I've got to sort of read everything that you guys were sending me to try and understand what it is I was seeing and liking. But it had already got me by that point. And I saw the benefits of me being into this artwork. It was helping people on my peripheral as well. They're all coming and going, oh, what's this? And I'm telling them about it.
Mm.
As I say, it just changed my life. No matter what anyone thinks of me now, there's a massive void between this me and the old me.
Yeah.
I can't thank you enough.
No, I think it's brilliant.
What piece that you've created, Gavin, do you think has got the strongest emotional connection?
Oh, I don't know. I always start with I don't know, don't I? I'm hearing that. I'm hearing myself do that. Each piece, when you think about an art work, piece, individual thing, they all are connected somehow to everything else. There's a point where it's always, when we say like a piece of work, it's always a bit partial. It's always kind of part of a body of work. And also, I think probably is made to fix problems that maybe you made, that you set up with and making a work for.
Mm.
Like you kind of, or you're solving problems by making a piece of the work, but at the same time as solving them, you're creating some more problems, and then you're having to solve those problems. So they're all kind of interrelated. I mean, there's definitely, and I'm haunted by it, the sort of infamous degree show that piece that I did, which was a blue plaque on the wall. And obviously, famously, I didn't get my degree for putting this work up there.
Absolutely beautiful.
And it wasn't my intention in any way. I mean, there was a lot of kind of things going on in the background where Justin Stevens, who was the rector of the Royal College, was just about to become head of English Heritage, and English Heritage awarded these plaques, but no one at the Royal College knew about it. And he was really paranoid and thought that I'd found out something about him. And so that was a backstory. No, we found that out a few years later when he hopped and jumped into English Heritage. And we were like, hang on a minute. I just basically lucked in there, really. And it was interesting because, for me, one of the things about art is that normally you can't really go wrong. Or you can't ever get a sense that you've gone wrong. No one's going to really tell you. That people aren't going to tell you that you've gone wrong. I mean, that's why I love that film, you know, The Rebel, Tony Hancock film, The Rebel. You know, this brilliant thing where he you know, makes this kind of sculpture on the boat of this wealthy guy's daughter, and they rip the cover off it, and everyone goes, oh, and they're horrified, and they literally hold their hands up to their mouths in sort of like shock and horror. And it's sort of like, it's just so good because that just doesn't ever happen, you know. Like, you know, it's such a wonderful kind of thing that you kind of feel would happen, but yeah. It never actually happens. It's just too good in that respect. So it's hard to know the edges. So one of the things about like failing is that there's this sense that it was unacceptable. Now, I've discussed earlier the reasons why it was unacceptable because of Justin Stevens, but I didn't know that. All I was told was unacceptable art. And, and obviously, if we look at music bands that have their records banned, that have their music banned, hang on, that always works well. You know, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, yeah, of course, or whatever it is. If a film that's banned, like Clockwork Orange, or, you know, anything that gets banned or is just too much or unacceptable, probably will live a lot longer than other things that don't get banned, which probably should have got banned, but they don't get banned. And I think there's also that point, the learning as well was this thing about converting energy. So here was this situation which I didn't want to happen, but it happened. And then in order to go forwards, I had to really convert that. I had to take that negative story and I had to turn that into a positive story. I did my, you know, but I did my O-level, my A-level, I got O-level A, A-level A. I got like a first with distinction for my degree, a commendation thing. And then I got a fail at the last hurdle, you know, the MA, you know. And I was like, whoa. What's this then? But I felt like I'd made the work I wanted to make, and so they could have fought me on the fact that I'd done what I wanted to do. So I did get a lot of support as well. I mean, I got some small little features in the newspapers. I got in like this brand new magazine that was coming out, Freeze, in the pilot issue, and I got in some other magazines, and lots of people kind of got energized by the whole story. The Time Out review of the degree show like mentioned me, and I got a lot of attention. And obviously that is an interesting thing with art as well. Yeah. It's like, if you give art attention, that's really all it wants, you know. Faint praise is the worst. It's like, yeah, it's okay,
yeah.
That's terrible. Yeah, exactly. That's the word. So you know, in that sense, it was very dynamic. There was stuff that was very dynamic. And so, as far as an education goes, it's really dynamic. If we talk about emotional as well, as your question asked for something emotional, yeah. I haven't answered the emotional bit, but then at the same time, there's something I want to say about emotional, which I don't know if it's quite the same, but I definitely feel... Well, I think when my art is at its best, there's always a small element of what I consider to be like embarrassment. I feel a slight sense of embarrassment. And I think that's probably because I'm revealing something, which I feel awkward about. And it's probably a truth, a self-truth. It's something that I don't quite and haven't quite understood or got to the bottom of, which I'm exposing. Maybe it's a naivety, I don't know. But I think that the work that has had the most kind of somehow importance is almost like that work that has that little element of embarrassment. Mm. And that's something I can't quite explain it any more than that. And if that's emotional, because I think when I listen to the word emotional, I hear something about a sort of something you can't quite explain, like a it's hard to put them into words, isn't it? Yeah. It's just like being moved, like the idea of being moved.
Could you have given up art when you got?
No, not at all. No. I was somewhere. Yeah,
just
I was going.
For a little
I was going somewhere. Definitely. I mean, some stuff got picked up and happened pretty quickly after that. So I didn't really have enough time to actually like sit down and go, oh no, I've failed this course now. I've got to give up and do something else.
They wouldn't have failed you on a whim, though, would they? It would have taken a lot of consideration. by a few people to sign that off that you weren't getting your degree.
Well, but then Justin Stevens was very powerful. Like he was like a massive kid who threw his toys out the pram. He threatened everyone with firing them. He literally said, "Oh, do you want to keep your jobs?" It would have. You're right. It would have had to have had a unanimous decision from all the people on the board on that panel,
yeah,
in order to fail me. There was, I think, there was nine people or seven people in this what was referred to as A B C D commission. The A B C D commission, seven people. I'd been round and personally spoken to four of them, who said, "Don't worry, Gavin, you've got my vote." So I already knew that I wasn't going to fail.
Yeah.
And then I got a thing saying you failed. And then only much later on did I find out that obviously, like, the extent that Justin Stevens bullied people in the room.
And did he get offered to you since?
No. No, although I did get... Although,
obviously, they can't give you your degree.
I have spoken to a posthumous degree. Well, I've spoken to post Stevens rectors of Royal College. I was in 175 years of art at the Royal College of Art. My plaque was actually in that show. I think a plastic version of the plaque is hanging in the senior common room.
Brilliant.
I mean, you know, my slides are... In fact, this was the thing where it happened, was like, I was in the slide library, and then the person who was working in the slide library got a phone call from the main building and said to me suddenly, like, "Oh, Gavin, I think you've got to go to the sculpture department now." I'm saying, "How do you know that?" He said, "Well, I just had a phone call to say that I've got to take your slides out of the slide library." And I'm like, "Hang on a minute. They don't know I'm in the slide library." She's just got a phone call, like, totally randomly, that the first point of this process is to take the student's slides out of the slide library.
Shit.
I should have said to them, "Right, you're never going to be able to put any of my slides back in the slide library, you know?" But it's fucking weird. I mean, actually, the slide library does have lots of my slides in it.
But isn't it a good story? It's a beautiful
It's a great
story.
Story, and it's a great story. And actually, like, that was another thing that I really learned a lot about. You know, with art, if you can have a story, and it doesn't necessarily need to be the art, you know, that arty... Sorry about this, everybody who's really into the arty story. Arty stories are important, and I tell them all the time. But just a story is really good. If it's something where, you know, "Oh, and this guy did this thing, and then he failed his degree," people get that. It's very communicative. It's very easy for people to get. They kind of go, "All right, I hear what you're saying." You know, it may be that they're not interested in the Royal College of Art, maybe not interested in degrees in art and dar. You know, and the whole question of our education is weird anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, what is a degree show? I mean, like, how do they market? I mean, who's marking it? What is the system they're using? Like, I passed my course. It was just simply the degree show. So it's like, how actually is it possible to fail a degree show?
Yeah,
I showed up, I put some stuff on the wall, I failed. What? That's impossible. It's impossible. And it doesn't make sense. You know, can you actually teach people art?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the other thing as well. I think you teach people open-mindedness. You teach people like mechanisms and ways that they can think, or that they can find ways of thinking. You help them to expand their minds, to open their possibilities to new ways of thinking. This is what you did. It's exactly what you did. You found a space in yourself where you went, oh, I can actually see the world in a different way, you know, and suddenly your horizons were expanded. You transformed.
Yeah.
And then you had loads of possibilities that weren't there before because you had closed. You were closed mind and you just had one way of looking at things. Suddenly you realised, oh, you go through a door and suddenly you go, oh my God, there's a whole new world out here.
Yeah.
I had no idea. You know, it's just that little shift. And you can go some way to saying to people, you know what, mate, there's a different way of doing this, a different way of seeing this, there's a different, you know, there's another way. You can tell these stories. You can sort of coax people and lead people into places where they unexpectedly have turned that corner and, you know, they're seeing the world in a new way.
I do see myself in a gallery sometimes and I go, how the fucking hell did I get here?
Yeah. But you've come a long way.
I feel like it.
Yeah.
One of your artworks is one of the few that has properly taken my breath away, and it was one of the sleeping bags, the bronze sleeping bags that you created when Saatchi was at the GLC building.
Mm.
You had your black skip in the foyer.
Mm.
But you had a sleeping bag in one of the entrances. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah.
And I've always worked with the homeless.
Yeah.
And had a sort of affinity with the homeless and marginalised. And when I first walked in, I see someone sleeping in the GLC building entrance.
Yeah.
And I thought, fucking good luck on him.
Yeah.
And I see he was sleeping. And then when I went over to him, the security guy sort of stepped forward. Then I see a plaque next to it.
Right.
He went, don't touch. And I just went and just knocked it with my knuckle. And I was like, fucking brilliant. And even before I knew it was yours, you know. Right. And yeah, it probably took.
Because it used
away.
To be the place where you'd go and pick up your check. You'd go and pick up your grants and stuff like that.
Yeah.
From that building, so it was quite weird. I mean, also there was a new story where Saatchi and landlord had to fight or something about the rent or I don't know what it was, but then there was a picture in the newspaper of the sleeping bag. And I think that the landlord in the story had kicked the sleeping bag. And it was really bad on lots of levels. It was bad on the level of like don't kick sculptures, but also don't kick like effigies of people who were sleeping on the street either. Yeah. You know, like it was. So the landlord was being portrayed in this really kind of evil way. The evil landlord. But obviously then, you know, Charles Saatchi is not either the hard done by, is he? The hard done by. No. Poor old Charles
Saatchi. Yeah, I don't think anyone's ever said that.
The sleeping bag piece was really hard to, it was hard to deliver that work. I mean, I've actually made a series of them, different coloured bags. But the first time I made it, I actually ended up putting it on the street outside my studio for a day and then watching it, just watching people go by and watching it on the street. And it was very late on in the day when it got discovered to be a sculpture, but it had also received like peanuts and nice, little bits of coins of money, and so it had little bits of food and money. People had been putting that down and walking by, so in a way, like people were actually like donating to it as a kind of almost like a shrine or something. But there was something interesting about this thing about visibility and the ability to look at a figure in a sleeping bag, sleeping rough on the street. Because obviously when you see that thing, you kind of make it real. It exists when you see it. And so when you make it real and it exists, you've made it real by seeing it, and therefore some responsibility for the fact that it's there, you've now incorporated. You've now taken on that. You've taken on a responsibility for that homeless person by realising that they're there in that way. And then there's also that curious thing of like, that's coupled together with people are absolutely obsessed by domestic, private, people's private lives. You know, like, they can't get enough, like, celebrity magazines looking in people's bedrooms, like, looking at their private collection of this, that and the other knickknacks, looking at their dogs and you know, the way their lifestyle. Yeah, yeah. Lifestyle is so important for people. They're obsessed with it. You know, watch telly programmes, like reality TV. You know, so in some ways, like a figure in a sleeping bag, this is this guy, this is his life, this is, wow. It, you know, so there's a human attachment to wanting to look at this thing, to wanting to stare, wanting to see, like, someone's private life as well. So there's this kind of awkward relationship between not wanting it to exist and wanting to walk by, and sort of, so it's not something you see, and then something you really want to see because you're actually obsessed with looking at. It's still hard to be challenged by having an artwork put in front of you which is in that place of, this is art, therefore you look at this thing, and that's how you come to an understanding of that thing. But this is one of those objects that you don't normally look at.
Yeah.
So you're now being allowed to look at something you don't normally look at, but then in a way, it's actually not really about, I mean, obviously there's the formal, like, as you said, you tap it or you touch it, and then suddenly, boom, the materiality becomes, like, blindingly clear. And you see it for what it is in terms of a crafted lump of bronze and, you know, paint and stuff. So it's a well-crafted object. So you can understand, look and see the craft in it. But over and above that, the reality of what it is and how it functions as a figure in space, as a figure in society, as a figure in our world, is that it starts to challenge you in terms of, like, what's inside, what's outside, what's your home. As you said, like, the margins, it starts to question your relationship to the margins, or it starts to look at the way that we understand who we are. It's a very metaphysical and it's one of those things for me. It questions, like, our reality. It's a sort of reality check. Yeah. And so it happens on a physical level, but it also happens on an intellectual and sort of, you know, it happens in a philosophical place as well.
Well, I like the idea that your artwork, when people are walking down Tottenham Court Road on a Sunday evening, it's pissing down the rain, they see your sleeping bag in the doorway. They'll think of you first, which makes them look at it. Then you've made them aware of homeless people now, you know, is the way I see it.
I hope so. I mean, it seems like totally twisted and weird to look at a homeless person and think of an artwork.
No.
But also, looking is a weird one, because I've got quite an interesting little story about a guy. I remember Cambridge Circus. This was a few years ago now, and it's like a cold day. But the sun was out, and it was shining sort of like down near where that Limelight, there used to be the Limelight
Club.
Yeah, the church. So it was just under there. They were doing some work. It was sort of like there was a scaffolding or something. There was a guy sitting there underneath, and he had this nosebleed. And then there was a policewoman who was leaning over him, sort of asking him something, talking to him. And there's this nosebleed, and the blood was sort of like all steaming like that. And she had little bits of high vis and stuff, and like her outfit, and he was kind of like sort of dishevelled and bleeding with like really tatty hair and like brown, like wrinkly skin. And I looked at it and I was like, oh wow, it's such like an amazing kind of Baroque painting or something. When I looked at it, I saw this. But I was like, God, if I had a camera now, that's amazing. Like, I've sort of, this is a gallery, you know, if I'd have set this up, it's amazing. Like, and then I walked past the whole thing, had my back to the whole thing. I was still sort of buzzing with the whole vision of it all. And then, vroom, I got caught the smell of the guy's blood mixed with a bit of urine and sweat.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, and I was nearly sick. Like, I was nearly sick. And the sickness was not only because I was sort of, I felt like, oh, I was mixing all my smells with his,
yeah,
I was basically we were conjoined.
Yeah.
But it was also because I suddenly got hit with the reality of it. Like, when it was there and I was just looking, I could see the whole thing objectively somehow, or I turned the whole thing into art. I turned it all into, like, yeah, subjective vision. Whereas when I went back to it and I then got the smell of it, like, I was in a different space. It was purely subjective. I couldn't be objective about it at all. I was, like, right in there. I was joining this, you know, my body and this thing. So it sometimes you get that thing with art where you do get that critical objective space to look at things out there in an objective world. And I think that's, you know, and that is useful as well. It can be useful, but also there's always a subjective element as well.
Because we're always asking people to look at what we're doing, but look at it from this angle, you know, look at it from that angle. But with a lot of your work, you're including the person in that. Look at this person from the offset. That has got me, you know. That's why when I have a little bit of that creative block, I'll always put in to, you know, to Google or something to get myself going. You, Sarah, or Mark Wallinger, use free, sort of get it, whatever it is. I have no idea what it is. But maybe it stems back from when you first sent me the stuff and it all connected. But whatever way, when I'm a bit dry for ideas, putting in them three names gets me back. And it was... Did you see the skip I done last year next to Dion's?
Oh.
The prison cell.
No.
Sleeping bag and the effect that it had on me,
yeah,
is what I was trying to portray with my skip.
Okay.
Which was... And then I looked up the size of a skip. One of them was 1,800 by 3.5 metres.
Mm-hmm.
And it had an area space of 6.3 metres altogether.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I'd have a look at the prison cell and found that a prison cell was 1,800 by 3.5 metres, the Victorian prison cell. And there was a diagram of it. This is on a government website.
Okay.
Exactly the same size as a skip.
Okay.
But in the end, I just recreated the diagram of the government diagram and laid it on the top of the skip.
Right.
So that in the hope that people would look at the skip like they would look at your sleeping bag and say, fucking hell, we put two adults in this.
Mm.
This is what we house two adults in this society. It's built for one, but we put two people in it, and it's a skip, so I called it domestic waste.
Right.
And then I thought, I see how much space animals need. The first one I come to was dogs. Mm-hmm. And if dogs are being held for procedure, a dog weighing 35 kilos and above has to have 8 square metres.
Mm.
But we put two adults in 6.3. Whenever I walk past a sleeping bag now, I think Gavin Turk. And a bin bag. And, you know, a black bin bag. And that's what I wanted people to do. I wanted people to look at the skip when they're walking down their street,
yeah,
and go, fucking hell, we house two people in one of those. So even that stemmed from you as well. Or the idea stemmed from you.
You've got me so... like, it's a very good idea. I like the idea of looking at the skip in terms of its dimensions.
Just so I can show you how close it is to Dion's. Dion was on here the other week.
On this podcast?
Yeah.
Okay. How did he do?
Good. He's went down really well.
He's very good.
I love Dion.
Is that actually how... Is that how big your cell was? No. The Victorian
That's
cell.
A Victorian one. But right. There's dozens of them Victorian... Dozens. There's thousands of them Victorian
that
ones.
That still go.
That's the feeling I was trying to go for. You know, I wasn't trying to relate it back to your...
No, but I think that's... I think that is... there's something quite interesting and quite kind of... penetrating about the idea that when you look at something in a open brackets real world closed brackets, that you then relate that thing back to when it's in its open brackets imaginary closed brackets world. Like, I get sent things like photographs in the middle of the night, like of a bag of rubbish. And someone said, oh, I saw this last night. It really reminded me of you. I'm like, brilliant. Like, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm sure you Probably had a few drinks.
When I was in Maddox Gallery in between the lockdowns, so the cleaner had just brought 3 bin bags up from downstairs
right. And
put them upstairs to take out. I went to the woman, how much are the Gavin Turks? You know, just as a little sort of funny, expecting her to chuckle, you know. But she went, hang on, actually, bin bags.
Oh, they're actually bin bags.
And I went, oh, no, sorry, silly man.
I know, there's a wonderful story about, because I have a bin bag work that's in the new art gallery, Walsall. And they had it downstairs for a while, in the downstairs area. And at Christmas, they put a Christmas tree up in the downstairs space, beside where the desk is. And there was a woman standing staring at the Christmas tree for ages. The woman behind the desk said, look, are you all right? Can I help you? And she said, is this just a Christmas tree like that? And the woman said, yeah, it's just a Christmas tree. She said, oh, that's lucky, because I thought it was a Gavin Turk. So suddenly, what was nice about that is that because people kind of see something they didn't expect to find, there's a bronze sculpture painted, it makes them question everything.
Yeah.
Suddenly, everything around them in an art gallery is potentially an artwork. And I love the idea that not only do we have it in the real world, like where people see a bin bag and they think of me, but that maybe some of the artwork in the gallery means that other things in the gallery, like you have to question them as to whether they are real or whether they're not. And that shift in like what you're looking at and how you're looking at it. And also, one of the things for me is the idea that audiencing an artwork is in itself perhaps part of a performance.
Mm.
So if I would go into an art gallery and I see someone bending down looking at a bin bag, like, yeah, we've got a sculpture which is a bin bag, but what I'm looking at is a performance artwork where someone is standing, leaning, looking at a cardboard box or looking at a bin bag. And that, for me, is like, oh, we're in a different place here now.
Yeah.
Like, the laws of what to look at and how to look are all different here. And I think that's part of the fun, I think.
But that woman with a Christmas tree has asked herself the fundamental question, is this art?
Yes.
And that's you know, that's what,
yes,
what everyone's trying to sort of answer or tell that same thing, isn't it?
Yes.
Can we talk of your spirit of painting at the Coronet Theatre?
Yes. I got asked to do a commission right at the top of the building. There's a domed roof, and on the roof, historically, and in the architectural plans, it was a design to have a figurative sculpture on the roof there.
Oh.
I think there was a figure on the roof.
Yeah.
At one point. When the building was first opened, there was a figure on the roof. I believe that it was a figure of Hermes. So there was already this prospect of a figure on the roof. Now, my first idea was actually to make a giant stepladder, a bronze stepladder, and have that straddling the roof, like with this idea that then there were some steps up to the sky, and, you know, it's like someone changing the light bulb or decorating the sky or something. And I made some, like, just models, and I showed it to Andrew Winter, the director of the Coronet, and she said, oh, that looks good, and, you know, she was kind of warm.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, and then I was kind of like, oh, yeah, and then I kind of thought a bit more, and then I kind of, it's a very hard space, it's very far, you know, it's very far up, very far away, and then I started thinking about the idea of some gestural figure, maybe like posing somehow on the roof. And then I found myself drifting to the courtyard outside the Royal Academy, where there's like this much too high up, but high up sculpture of Sir Joshua Reynolds. And here's this guy who kind of, it's actually, I think the sculpture's made in the 1920s.
Do you think he's placed that high for his steam?
I don't know why.
He's, you're right. He's just a bit too high.
It's a bit too high. Too low. Or Nelson's column.
Yeah, it's too low to be high and sort of too high to be comfortable.
I mean, in that courtyard as well, it is curiously high.
Yeah.
In that courtyard. But anyway, I think there was something about this idea of a sculpture, of a painter, at this sort of sculpted celebration of the painter. And then obviously I've got this whole succession of artworks where I'm pointing a gun, I'm pointing, I'm falling back. But there's always this one hand pointing and the other hand is kind of down to the side or doing something. And I just sort of thought, do you know what? Maybe I should do a sculpture of this, of me as Joshua Reynolds, and stick that on the roof. And I then proposed that, and she said, oh, yeah, that sounds good. But by that stage, I think I was like, yeah, do you know what? I'm just going to do that. So I just did it.
And was it your head on his body, or was
no,
it you?
No. So it's me sort of wearing overalls, yeah. I've sort of got my shoes, boots on, and I've got a beret on. So he's like, Joshua Reynolds has got a wig on and he's got this kind of dress coat, frock coat type thing. In a strange way, the character on the roof, that my character, looks much more like some sort of strange socialist kind of like leader or some sort of... It definitely doesn't look like a kind of conservative thing. I think it's interesting to have this attempt to think about the idea of the, you know, the slightly larger than life figurative sculpture in a period where lots of sculptures of middle-aged white guys are being checked and maybe taken down, because they don't sort of pass the sort of ethics committee. I suppose I was kind of playing with that idea of inside and outside, but then also just the sculpture's sort of too far away.
Yeah,
it's too far away really to see that much. So all it is kind of like attitude, and all it is in a funny sort of way is like the sculpture of a figure painting, a bit like the you know Tony Hancock and the Rebel. It's a bit like it is permanent. Yeah. But it is very much like a kind of like a sort of just an attitude, but a kind of ridiculous, ridiculous attitude, like kind of.
And like the original, it's a bit too far out of reach.
Yeah, it's too far. The only place you can see it is you have to go back down the road to look up. I mean, when you're actually at the door, you can't see it at all. So you have to be back down the road. You could probably only ever see it when you're like 100 meters away from it, and it now it's interestingly enough. It's now home to a seagull.
Brilliant.
So it permanently has a seagull on it. Yeah. So it's got a second sculpture, which is that resident seagull.
You standing next to it, and that's why I didn't know whether you were sort of arcing back to previous work where you would place your head on a historic figure.
Well, the thing is, I've never actually just placed my head on a historic figure. I've always used. You know, it's always been me
dressing up
kind of thing. Yeah. So it isn't just simply just placing my head on. I mean, it is interesting, the idea of the Photoshop. If I start this thing in 1993, obviously they did have Photoshop in 1993, but it wasn't technologically. It wasn't quite so. Now everyone sticks everyone's head. There's actually face swap, you know, everyone's got it on their phone, you know, it's like everyone's head just gets stuck on everything else. And, you know, like deep fakes now and images can be changed so quickly and easily that it almost makes no sense to even talk about it. But in actual fact, you know, just to bring the conversation back to, like, not that long ago, my life. You know, there was definitely a time, you know, going back to leaving college even, where it wasn't so straightforward and easy just to swap. Actually, for my, it was the card that accompanied my show. I had a picture of a soldier's head on a Union Jack, and it was the front page of the Sun newspaper. And it said, "Support our boys, put this flag in your window." And it was a picture that the Sun ran for that people were supposed to put up in their window. And I, rather than the beret worn to one side, I took a picture of me, like with the beret kind of a bit up and like an artist beret, and stuck that over the top like a collage on top of the other guy's head, and then turned that, photographed that, and turned that into the card that accompanied the plaque. In fact, someone said that they met this lady who came to the degree show, and she thought that I'd been killed in the Iraq-Iran war, and or whatever it was, and that other students had put the plaque up in my memory, and that the card was a picture of me as a soldier.
Little bit of solidarity with their fallen student.
What the hell? Oh my god! I mean, it takes all sorts, though, doesn't it? That's the thing.
Just. Well, I'll leave it there, mate. Thank you very much.
I think that was lovely. I think what's beautiful about it is you just feel it. You really feel it. Like, you really feel the art thing. It's so important for you. It's really, like you say, it's changed your life. And it, you know, for me, I just drifted into it. So I've never really got that beautiful kind of like, oh, kind of moment. The Damascus moment.
You must get through people's artwork.
You see some bit of art and suddenly you're like, whoa.
Probably gets me there.
I mean, the thing is, well, you see, one of the things I like about art is where I see something, it catches me, but it may be months or even years later that I go, oh, wow. One of the great things with art, and one of the things I've learned, is that you can't always get it straight away. It might not happen in a predictable way.
Yeah.
It's unpredictable. For that reason, it's infinitely enjoyable. That, for me, is, it's infinitely enjoyable.
Hello, I'm Vasalia Chilton, the director of Kensington and Chelsea Art Week and Art Trail. The artist you've just been listening to is part of the Kensington and Chelsea Art Week and Art Trail. The Art Trail starts on the 18th of June and ends on the 31st of August. You can find all the details on our website, kcaw.co.uk. Thank you so much for listening.
Well, hope you enjoyed that episode of the Ministry of Arts podcast. So we wasn't dictated to by advertisers, we decided from the offset to go ad-free, which means obviously we had to self-fund. So we set up the Ministry of Arts Patreon page. And without that support, we would not be able to produce this podcast. So if you like what you hear and you're able to support the podcast, just go over to the Ministry of Arts Instagram profile. You'll find a Linktree drop-down box, which will direct you straight to our Patreon page. And for the price of a cup of coffee, you can help keep us growing week by week. But if you're not able to do that, that's fine, because this content is free for everyone. But leaving a review on whichever platform you listen to your podcast, that really does help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast. Or even giving us a positive shout out on your social media. Everything is appreciated. But either way, thanks for listening. And until next week, ta-da.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.